secured a lucrative contract to supply 10% of Chicago's natural gas needs, up to 200 million cubic feet per day. However, as the years passed, the wells operated by Mitchell Energy and Development were declining. He needed to discover new sources of petroleum, or else. Mitchell was under the sway of an influential report published in 1972 by an international team of scientists led by Dennis L. Meadows at MIT titled The Limits to Growth. The scientists examined a number of variables, population, food production, industrialization, pollution, and consumption of non-renewable natural resources, all of which were increasing exponentially. Under the assumption of no major change in the present system, the authors emphatically warned in the section dealing with declining natural resources, population and industrial growth will certainly stop within the next century at the latest. Even under a more optimistic scenario in which the available natural resources doubled, pollution would overload the capacity of the environment to absorb it, leading to the same dire outcome. The basic behavior mode of the world system is exponential growth of population and capital, followed by collapse. The only way to halt the march to disaster is to achieve what the authors called equilibrium. That would mean sacrificing certain liberties, such as producing unlimited numbers of children or consuming uncontrolled amounts of resources. As the father of 10 children, Mitchell certainly hadn't done much to control population, but he was deeply engaged with the concept of responsible growth and environmental welfare. In 1974, he founded a planned community outside Houston called the Woodlands, designed to be ecologically mindful. It is now the home to more than 100,000 residents and a number of corporate campuses. Mitchell began holding conferences there, inspired by the ideas in The Limits to Growth. He and his wife, Cynthia, formed a foundation that is largely dedicated to promoting ideals of sustainability. In 1980, Mitchell predicted that there were only about 35 years of conventional sources of petroleum remaining in the U.S. The obvious alternative was coal, which had dire implications for the environment. Natural gas, on the other hand, was far cleaner, almost an ideal fuel in Mitchell's opinion. But was there enough gas remaining to prevent the world from returning to a time when coal-burning fireplaces coated the cities in black ash and smog filled the air with dangerous pollutants? Mitchell still faced the immediate problem of fulfilling his contract with the city of Chicago. His company's main assets were the leases he held on 300,000 acres 70 miles northwest of Dallas, in a region known to oil men as the Fort Worth Basin. A mile and a half below the surface was a formation called the Barnett Shale. Geologists had speculated that the Barnett, which extends 5,000 square miles and spreads through 17 counties, contained the largest gas reserves of any onshore field in the United States. The problem was that nobody knew how to extract the gas. Porous formations, like the Woodbine sands that Dad Joyner had tapped, allow the flow of liquids and gases, but the Barnett Shale is tight rock, meaning that it has very low permeability. In the mid-20th century, prospectors attempted to liberate petroleum reserves by pulverizing tight rock. Imaginative techniques using dynamite, machine guns, bazookas, and napalm were tried, without success. In 1967, the Atomic Energy Commission, working with the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and the El Paso Natural Gas Company, exploded a 29-kiloton nuclear bomb, dubbed Gas Buggy, 4,000 feet underground, near Farmington, New Mexico. More than 30 other nuclear explosions followed in what was called Project Plowshare. Natural gas, it turned out, could be extracted from the atomized rubble, but the gas was radioactive. A safer and more precise method, developed in the 70s, was to use jets of fluid under intense pressure to create micro-cracks in the strata, typically in sandstone or limestone. Expensive gels or foams were typically used to thicken the fluid, and biocide was added to kill the bacteria that can clog the cracks. A granular substance called propant, made of sand or ceramics, was pumped into the cracks, keeping pathways open so that the hydrocarbons could journey to the surface. The process came to be known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. It certainly did jostle loose the captured oil or gas molecules, but as far as Mitchell was concerned, it had a fatal flaw. It was too costly to turn a profit in shale. His quest was to find a way to liberate the gas and save his company, and perhaps the world. In 1981, Mitchell drilled his first fracked well in the Barnett Shale, the C.W. Slay No. 1. It lost money. Year after year, Mitchell continued drilling in the Barnett. He sank $250 million into this venture, hoping to formulate a cheaper and more effective fracking formula. 17 years later, Mitchell's company was in real trouble. His shareholders had begun to think he was a crank. The company was heavily in debt, and his share price had plunged from $30 to $10. And yet Mitchell kept drilling one unprofitable well after another. To cut costs, one of Mitchell's engineers, Nick Steinsberger, began tinkering with the fracking fluid formula. He reduced the quantity of gels and chemicals, making the liquid more watery, and added a cheap lubricant, polyacrylamide, which is used in the manufacture of face creams and soft contact lenses. The resulting slick water, aided by a dusting of sand for the propant, worked beautifully. It also cut the cost of fracking by more than two-thirds. Mitchell combined this new formula with horizontal drilling techniques that had been developed offshore. Once you bored deep enough to reach a deposit, you could steer the bit through the oil or gas-bearing seam, a far more efficient means of recovery than just going straight down. In 1988, after about 300 attempts, Mitchell's company finally made a profit on a fracked well in the Barnett, the S.H. Griffin No. 4. The shale revolution was underway. The same fracking innovations that Mitchell had pioneered in gas were almost immediately applied to oil. For the third time in Texas history, the state transformed the energy business in ways that would shake economies and stir political quarrels all over the globe. In July 2008, oil prices had reached an all-time peak, $145.31. But the frackers were just getting started. By 2010, there were more than 14,000 wells in the Barnett alone, and the economic formula of past Texas booms held: a sudden fortune, a glut, a crash in prices. By January 2016, oil had fallen to less than $30 a barrel. "We're back to where we were in 1931, Robert Bryce, an author and journalist who writes frequently about the energy business, told me. Texas drillers are once again determining the price of the marginal barrel in the world market. Two things are going on, Mac Fowler, an oil man and philanthropist in Houston, told me as he laid out several graphs for my education. The first showed the U.S. production of crude oil. In 1970, American oil production reached nearly 10 million barrels a day. That summit was followed by a long, slow slide, decade after decade, touching bottom in 2008 at little more than 5 million barrels a day. The decline was marked by oil embargoes, price shocks, gas lines, shifting geopolitical alliances, wars in the Middle East, and the fear of the world economy being held captive to oil states that were often intensely anti-American. Then, around the time Barack Obama was elected president, something startling happened. U.S. production shot back up, approaching its all-time high. On the graph, it looked like a flagpole. In the span of 5 years, we go from 5.5 million barrels a day to 9.5 million, almost doubling the U.S. output, Fowler said. It was the fastest growth in oil production ever seen. The difference was fracking and horizontal drilling techniques. 5,000 energy-related companies make their home in Houston, the world's energy capital, and the effect of the crash in prices caused by the shale oil boom was evident in the slowdown in home sales, empty office buildings, and diminished traffic on the freeways. One Houston restaurant in the storied River Oaks neighborhood, Wheezy's Table, began offering a three-course meal each Wednesday night, pegged to the price of a barrel of oil. When I visited in the spring of 2016, it was about $38. At oil's peak in June 2014, that meal might have cost $115. Between January 2015 and December 2016, more than 100 U.S. oil and gas producers declared bankruptcy, half of them in Texas. That doesn't count the financial impact on the pipeline, storage, servicing, and shipping companies that depend on the energy business, and the colossal debt, $74 billion so far, much of it unsecured, that these failures leave behind. Recently, I drove to North Texas to visit the well that started the revolution, the S.H. Griffin No. 4. It stands amid a little community of prefab homes and tidy brick bungalows, marking the extended reach of the Fort Worth suburbs. The town used to be called Clark, but a decade ago, the mayor made a deal with a satellite network to provide 10 years of free basic service to the 200 residents in return for renaming the town after the company, using all capital letters, as in the company logo. Satellite dishes still sit atop many houses there, and even though the agreement has expired, the town's name remains Dish. This part of Texas is flat grassland, dotted with scrubby mesquite. You see a lot of heavy industry associated with pipelines and drilling. Tanker trucks, which carry the millions of gallons of water required to frack a well, and tractor trailers, known as sand cans, which haul silica to the site, have worn down the roads. Each drilling rig is huge and arrives disassembled in a dozen truckloads of parts. There is also the 4-inch metal pipe for the hole, which comes in 30-foot lengths weighing 600 pounds apiece, the concrete to encase the pipe, and the carbon steel transmission pipes between 2 and 3 feet in diameter that transport the gas to storage containers. About 1,200 truck deliveries are needed for every well that is fracked. Before the fracking comes the drilling. In the Barnett, holes go down about 6,000 to 8,000 feet, substantially below the water table. Once the desired depth is reached, the drill slowly bends until it becomes horizontal, for as much as another 10,000 feet. There is a science fiction quality to the fracking process. Several tubes called perforating guns are snaked to the end of the wellbore. The guns contain explosives that rupture the surrounding strata. Meanwhile, on the surface, 20 or so trucks line up on either side of the well. Pipes and hoses emanating from the trucks connect to a metal apparatus known as a manifold, which looks like a giant alien insect. A mighty sound suddenly erupts as the trucks begin pumping 800 gallons of fluid and proppant a minute into the manifold and down the well, opening up fresh microfractures in the shale. The process is repeated again and again until the entire horizontal plane of the well has been blasted open. It takes about a month to bring a well into production. The S.H. Griffin No. 4 is in a grassy field inside a cage of chain-link fencing. It looks small and inert on the surface, and few neighbors seem to appreciate its historic significance. Unlike an oil well, there is no pump jack. Instead, the well is capped by what is known in the industry as a Christmas tree, a bunch of pipes and valves that control the flow of gas and direct the emissions into olive-green condensate tanks. On the northern horizon, there was a cloud of black smoke, perhaps from an oil fire or a gas flare. Fracking is a dark bounty. It has created enormous wealth for some. The flood of natural gas has lowered world energy costs and blunted the influence of traditional oil economies, such as Saudi Arabia and Russia. It has also despoiled communities and created enduring environmental hazards. As in many Texas towns where fracked wells have become commonplace, the citizens of Dish were anxious. In 2010, the little town paid $15,000 for an air quality study. It found elevated amounts of benzene, a carcinogen, and other harmful chemicals, but not at levels that are known to endanger health. If you drew a circle of a mile around my house, there were probably 200 wells inside it, the former mayor, Calvin Tillman, told me. His children started getting nosebleeds when gassy odors were present. One of my boys got a nosebleed that was all over his hands, Tillman recalled. There was blood dripping down the walls. It looked like a murder scene. The next morning, my wife said, "That's it." They sold their house at a loss and moved to a community that is not on the Barnett Shale. The nosebleeds went away. Since then, additional emission controls have been installed in the wells around Dish. The frackers advanced 15 miles northeast to the city of Denton. It is now thought to be the most heavily fracked city in the country. Wells have been drilled near schools and hospitals and on the campus of the University of North Texas. In 2008, multiple earthquakes were recorded in the area, and according to a study conducted at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, more than 200 quakes have followed. The study concluded that the quakes have most likely been caused by the 1.7 billion barrels of wastewater that have been pumped into the region's 167 injection wells, which are used to dispose of fracking fluids. Even after environmental activists recorded 12 earthquakes over a 24-hour period in and around Irving, where ExxonMobil is headquartered, in January 2015, energy executives and state regulators maintain that the earthquakes were a natural phenomenon. I started sounding the alarm pretty early, Sharon Wilson, who once worked in the energy industry, told me. In 2008, she sold the mineral rights on a small horse ranch that she owned in Wise County. "My air turned brown and my water turned black," she said. "I moved to Denton thinking that my family would have some level of safety there." As she was unpacking, she noticed a well being drilled across the street from a nearby city park. George Mitchell had been reluctant to admit that the fracking revolution that he unleashed had damaging consequences for the environment. He was caught off guard by the backlash, his son Todd, a geologist, recalls. Todd informed his father that, although natural gas caused less air pollution than coal, industrial leakages of natural gas, especially of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, could render it no better than coal in terms of global warming. Mitchell also came to appreciate the damage caused by the industrialization of the landscape in communities subjected to intensive drilling. In 2012, the year before he died, he and New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg co-authored an op-ed for the Washington Post, arguing for increased regulation. "The rapid expansion of fracking has invited legitimate concerns about its impact on water, air, and climate, concerns that the industry has attempted to gloss over," they wrote. "Safely fracking natural gas can mean healthier communities, a cleaner environment, and a reliable domestic energy supply." Mitchell expressed himself more succinctly to his son-in-law, Perry Lorenz, an Austin developer. "These damn cowboys will wreck the world to get an extra 1% of profit," Mitchell said. "You got to sit on them." Unfortunately, Mitchell's plea has gone largely unheeded in Texas. Sharon Wilson began volunteering in Denton for Earthworks, a national environmental organization with a focus on accountability in the oil and gas industry. Earthworks joined forces with a local organization, the Denton Drilling Awareness Group. Their campaign led, in November 2014, to a ban on fracking in the city limits. "It should send a signal to the industry that if the people in Texas, where fracking was invented, can't live with it, nobody can," Wilson said at the time. In short order, the state legislature, which is slavishly devoted to the oil and gas industry, passed a law prohibiting any such ban. Now cities in Texas have almost no recourse when frackers move in. There are 300 wells in Denton already, and a third of the landmass of the city has been platted for future wells now that the legislature has given the green light. "People think there are health consequences," Ed Soff, who used to teach jazz studies at the university, told me. "Kids were getting asthma. There were nosebleeds and headaches. The silica coated the neighborhood in dust. There was the odor, the noise. The kids couldn't play outside. They would get sick. It's that simple. In October 2015, unable to stop fracking in the city, the Denton Municipal Electric Utility announced its intention to derive 70% of its electricity from renewable resources by 2019, making it one of the cleanest energy providers in the state. If you have ever flown over West Texas above the region surrounding Midland and Odessa, you may have noticed something that looks like graph paper stretched across the flatland prairie for hundreds of square miles. This is the Permian Basin, and each intersection on the graph marks an oil or gas well. No region on Earth has been more thoroughly drilled. Nearly 30 billion barrels of sweet, low-sulfur oil known as West Texas Intermediate have come out of this field, roughly the size of South Dakota, and more than that remains. Because of the fracking revolution, it is once again the hottest oil and gas play in the world. For the first time ever, the United States holds more proved oil reserves than either Saudi Arabia or Russia. More than half of the U.S. total is in shale. New technology has decreased the cost of production to the point that fracking is becoming competitive with traditional means of extraction. Production in the Permian Basin has doubled in the last 5 years to 2.4 million barrels a day, and the break-even cost of a fracked well has plummeted to as low as $25 a barrel. This has had dramatic consequences for more expensive means of production, such as coal tar extraction and ocean drilling. In September 2016, Apache Corporation, a Houston-based oil and gas exploration company, announced the discovery of an entirely new field in the Permian Basin called Alpine High, estimated to contain 75 trillion cubic feet of gas and 3 billion barrels of oil. That was followed in November by an announcement from the U.S. Geological Survey that the Wolf Camp Formation within the Permian Basin contains an estimated 20 billion barrels of oil, the largest continuous oil accumulation that USGS has assessed in the United States to date, according to the agency, plus an additional 16 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Within a decade, the assessment of newly discovered recoverable oil in the Permian Basin alone has increased by more than 800%. Moreover, productivity per well has shot up, according to Robert Bryce. The amount of oil produced by a new well in the Permian stayed flat from 2007 to 2013 at about 100 barrels per day. But from 2013 to 2016, while the rig count was falling dramatically, the productivity of a new well rose to 500 barrels a day, a fivefold increase in 3 years. Multiply that rate of productivity by the newly discovered oil and factor in the declining cost of recovery, and you will have a rough calculation of the future of energy. The little town of Balmoray lies within the vast Apache field, as does one of the most glorious spring-fed swimming holes in the state, an oasis more than an acre in size, which attracts tourists from all over the world. Aside from the natural beauty, the pool is home to two endangered species of fish. Locals are concerned that the water table will be contaminated by leakage from a disposal well or an earthquake. The town happens to sit on a geological fault line. Apache, which maintains that its methods are safe and proven, promises not to drill within the town limits or beneath the state park that contains the swimming hole. But it's hard to imagine that there won't be considerable environmental consequences from the 5,000 wells envisioned to extract all that oil. Those costs have to be measured by other benefits, the decent jobs that will come to the region, for instance, and the taxable income that will support city services. There are also undeniable geopolitical advantages in reducing American dependence on foreign oil and lowering the cost of energy. Because of fracking, there is an abundance of natural gas, which is killing demand for coal, a trend that the Trump regime is unlikely to be able to stop. Gas burns far cleaner than coal, and as a result, greenhouse gas emissions in the United States are at their lowest point in a quarter century. Texas is the only state to have its own electrical grid, which was created largely to avoid federal regulations. The state invested $7 billion in high-voltage transmission lines to carry wind power through the shrub-covered plains eastward toward the cities. Because of the intense energy needs of the oil and gas business involving oil refineries and petrochemical plants, Texas uses far more electricity than any other state, 67% more than second-place California. And yet, electricity in Texas is cheaper than the national average, in some places actually free at night. That's because Texas gets about 17% of its electricity from wind power, and wind generally blows more at night, when demand is lower. The plains and caprock mesas of West Texas, as well as the coastal region south of Galveston, are lined with regiments of wind turbines. They are so heavily subsidized by the federal government that the wind energy producers sometimes pay companies to take the energy off their hands in order to receive their federal tax credits. On some days, wind satisfies half of the state's electricity demand. In the first quarter of 2017, wind generation accounted for 23% of the power generated in the state. In October, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, broke a bottle of champagne atop a 300-foot turbine to inaugurate a vast new wind farm in Scurry County in northwest Texas, which will provide another 1 million megawatt hours a year to the grid. Solar energy is also growing, but it has been slower to catch on, despite abundant and intense sunshine. Austin gets nearly a fourth of its power from renewable sources and aims to double that in 10 years. Georgetown, just north of Austin and one of the most conservative suburbs in the state, already gets all of its electricity from renewable sources. Nick Fowler, the younger brother of Mac Fowler, the oil man I met in Houston, operates a petrochemical plant in Odessa. Nick is a ruddy man whose strikingly white hair and mustache look like a disguise. He is what is known as a downstream oil man. Upstream are the people who find the oil and the money to drill. Midstream are the pipeline operators and people who move the product to refineries and to market. At the end of the stream, Nick makes a kind of plastic that is a byproduct of the refining of gasoline. We take a hydrocarbon and turn it into a polymer, he explained as he showed me around the plant, with its inscrutable towers and a maze of pipes and gangplanks. I remembered as a child seeing plants like this lit up at night on the flat horizon, like some kind of Mad Max skyscrapers. Nick handed me a sample of his end product, a malleable glob, which in the trade is called a potato, although it more closely resembles a pregnant ravioli. It's a form of polypropylene used for hot melt adhesives, he told me. I recognized it then as the same substance I use in a hot glue gun. When melted, the potato becomes spreadable. The biggest use is in the assembly of non-woven materials, like in feminine hygiene products, disposable diapers, panty liners, adult incontinence, Nick said. Our adhesives hold the layers together. Diapers are a very complicated structure. Unfortunately, on the day I visited, the plant was on the blink. As he drove me through the facility, Nick rolled down the window and stopped to talk to his three engineers. A train car was waiting to take the next shipment of polymer to market, and who knows how many fortunes were being lost, but the engineers were unfazed. Actually, they all seemed a little amused and excited. They had an interesting problem to work on. The lead engineer, J.J. DeCare, speculated about what might be wrong, possibly a water leak in a condenser. Nick drove on, praising his crew. J.J. was self-taught, an American genius of the same ilk as Wilbur and Orville Wright. It takes a lot of ingenuity to run a petrochemical plant. Here they were, in one of the most desolate parts of Texas, on a 100-degree day, having a pretty great time. Later that afternoon, Nick drove me to the Odessa Country Club for dinner. On the highway next to a strip club, there was a large lot where unused oil rigs were stored. Every Friday at noon, Baker Hughes, a giant oil field services company in Houston, releases a rig count. a measure of how many new wells are being drilled in the U.S. It is the most closely watched barometer of the drilling industry's health. On that Friday evening in June 2016, when Nick and I went to dinner, only 421 rigs were being put to use in the U.S., less than a tenth of the 4,500 rigs that were at work in December 1981, the highest count since records began to be kept. In the lot that Fowler and I passed, there were 47 unused rigs lined up in parallel ranks. They cost $15 to $18 million apiece, Nick observed. He estimated the total investment of the idle rigs to be as much as $850 million. We sat in the empty dining room, watching a storm blow in across the flayed landscape. Golfers raced into the clubhouse as lightning lit up the giant black sky like war. The rain itself was paltry, typical of the noisy, uncharitable storms of this part of Texas. Through the picture window, the idle rigs on the horizon, illuminated by the blinding flashes, look like ideal lightning attractors. There have long been dreams of harvesting the electrical power of Texas's many lightning strikes. In 2006, a company called Alternative Energy Holdings announced its intent to create lightning farms, and it actually set up an experimental lightning capture tower in Houston, where there are lots of electrical storms and a huge demand for power. Nothing came of it. But I was reminded of the scene in Back to the Future where Marty McFly has to capture energy from a lightning bolt on the clock tower in order to power his DeLorean back to present time. I asked Nick if he ever thought of leaving Odessa. Only on mornings when the sun rises in the east, he admitted. When the weather's nice, it's delightful, although it's still not very attractive. On the other hand, he liked being in a place where the people at the laundry know your name. Mainly, he was comforted by the 210 good jobs he provided. Fracking saved the economy of the Permian Basin, Nick observed, but it wasn't going to last forever. When he and Mac were boys, their parents took them on vacation to Colorado, and they stopped in Leadville, headquarters of the great silver boom in the 1880s. Leadville then sported a dozen theaters, including the Grand Tabor Opera House, where Oscar Wilde and Harry Houdini performed. The lobby floor of a hotel was paved with silver dollars. After Denver, it was the largest city in the state. Only a few thousand people live there now. It's a meager tourist stop, a gateway to the gold mining ghost towns in the mountains. At best, Nick said, the Permian Basin has another 25 years before it follows the same path. Fortunes change. People move on. How can it be any different in Odessa? I remember, after the great bust in the 1980s, there were bumper stickers reading, "Please, God, send me one more oil boom. This time, I promise not to piss it away." That bust lasted nearly 20 years. Societies that depend on natural resources tend to have certain inherent problems. The centralization of wealth, whether from oil, coal, diamonds, or any extractable commodity, often leads to corruption and authoritarianism. Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and Louisiana are primary examples. In such a society, the economy rises and falls by a single measure. Where money comes out of the ground, luck and a willingness to take risks are the main factors that determine one's future, not talent or education or hard work. Money, so easily acquired, comes to seem well-deserved because those who have it must be either uniquely perspicacious or divinely favored. In good times, a kind of forgetfulness falls over the land. It's easy to make money when the price of oil skyrockets and building cranes loom over the cities like praying mantises and the malls are jammed and you can't get a dinner reservation. Then the reckoning arrives. The central fact about boom societies is that they inevitably go bust. The collapse of oil prices beginning in the early 1980s, then falling into an abyss in 1986, put an end to one of the most expansive periods in Texas history, bringing down the savings and loan industry and puncturing the real estate bubble that had created so much illusory wealth. In the age of money, Roberta and I watched many of our friends sending their children to private schools named Saint This or Saint That. They spent their evenings going over architectural plans and generally lived life as it is glimpsed in magazine ads. Occasionally, we made the mistake of going out to dinner with them. We spent more on the tip than Roberta and I would ordinarily spend on a meal. A few years into the decline, I was serving on a jury in Travis County, which includes Austin. During a recess, I walked out of the courthouse to get some air, and there was a mob of people on the steps, pushing themselves forward to grab a paper that was being handed out. I had gotten used to signs of economic distress by then. Department stores were shuttered. Vacant skyscrapers were called see-throughs. Out-of-state interests bought up our newspapers and banks so that we lost control of our sources of information and finance. Now serving breakfast banners foretold the next restaurant about to close. One of my neighbors, an engineer who worked for the city, lost his house and moved into his Volkswagen van. But I had never seen foreclosed properties for sale on the courthouse steps. My father, who was a retired banker by this time, watched many of his friends and colleagues in Dallas go through bankruptcy. They had been some of the most respected people in the city, the money men who had raised Dallas 50 stories into the air. One of Daddy's friends, Jim Toler, a jovial former college football star, was the mayor of Garland near Dallas. At Christmas, we always got a burlap bag of pecans inscribed, "Nuts to You," from Jim Toler. He had made a fortune on a crazily speculative suburban condominium development along the I-30 corridor. Some of the properties were sold as many as 8 times in a day, starting at $100,000 in the morning and winding up at $1 million by nightfall. There was a lot of fraud involved. Savings and loan associations, once known as thrifts because they were supposed to be more cautious financial institutions, had been deregulated in the Carter administration, and they became the piggy banks for the speculators. They were making loans on the properties at 110% of the grossly inflated values, meaning that buyers, instead of putting money down, got a cash bonus when they signed the loan. You'd walk away with thousands of dollars in your pocket. The concept spread like a virus, infecting SNLs all over the Southwest. When the scheme collapsed, more than 700 financial institutions in the country were shuttered. Toler was eventually convicted on 41 counts of conspiracy, racketeering, and bank fraud. Daddy used to visit him in prison. Our former governor, John Connally, who had been Secretary of the Treasury under President Nixon, suffered a humiliating bankruptcy auction. He sat gallantly with his wife, Nellie, over the 4 days it took to dispose of their luxurious possessions, including his ceremonial saddles, extensive gun collection, Persian rugs, and even a Santa Claus cookie jar. At the end, Nellie salvaged a cardboard box so that Big John could have a bedside table for his alarm clock. Texas was riveted by the Connellys' plight. But they were merely the grand marshals of the bankruptcy parade, which included Denton Cooley, the great heart surgeon in Houston, who owed $100 million on his unprofitable real estate holdings. The Hunt brothers, William Herbert, Nelson Bunker, and Lamar, who were $1.5 billion in debt after two of them tried to corner the market in silver. And the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Clint Murchison Jr., who died broke. Even Willie Nelson was wiped out, owing nearly $32 million in back taxes, one of the largest individual tax liabilities ever generated by the IRS. The government seized almost everything he owned except his guitar, which he hid at his daughter's house. That still didn't pay the tax collector, so he made a record to pay off what he could. It was called The IRS Tapes, Who'll Buy My Memories? One day in 1989, while our children were in Saturday morning music classes in Austin, Roberta was talking to some of the other parents about real estate. We had invested in a little rent house with a friend, paying $62,500 for it only 4 years before. Now it was worth half that. Roberta asked one of the mothers about the house she had had for sale for months. Well, we deeded it back to the bank, the woman said. It cost us $100,000, but at least it's off our backs. Then another mother asked, Oh, how do you do that? It turned out that every single parent in the group was thinking the same thing. They were all looking for some relief from their crushing financial burdens. I knew about the fall of financial titans. I had read about the sleazy dealings of some of our most prominent political figures and the corruption and mismanagement of our financial institutions. But when the bill for these misdeeds came due, it was paid mainly through the suffering of ordinary people. For some, the downturn passed by unnoticed. That same mother who told Roberta about deeding her house back to the bank recalled that the very next day her son was picked up for a concert by a friend in a Rolls Royce with mink-covered seats. I looked around at the legacy of the great oil-fueled boom of the 1970s and early 1980s that had come to such a crashing end. Where were the cultural institutions, the schools, the public art? What I saw instead were cruddy strip shopping centers, garish beach communities, the ugly sprawl of car lots and franchise chicken joints and prefab warehouses that issued out of the heart of every city and crawled along our highways like poison vines. Texas, in the wake of the boom, was revealed to be a civilization built on greed and impermanence, a civilization that was here to take, not to give. It was odd, because Texans were always talking about how much they loved the state, but I wondered where was the evidence of that love. I thought about what had brought us to this point. What was the source of the greed, the blunders, the bullheaded arrogance that had led to this monumental crack-up? It was clearly a culture that confused wealth with value, where every notable personality had to be a millionaire. Even during the downturn in the 80s, Texas Monthly published an annual review called the Texas 100 of the wealthiest Texans. To strike it rich is still the Texas dream, although the state has never been rich in the way that Maryland and Connecticut and other old money eastern states are. Even Nebraska has more millionaires per capita than Texas. And yet, when people all over the world think of Texas, they still think of big money. You can tell the oil is gushing when they start selling those oversized dollars in the airport souvenir shops. I considered leaving Texas then. I don't know why I didn't. But something important happened in the wake of that mighty crash. There was a stronger sense of community as people hunkered down. The national schadenfreude that greeted the downfall of the Texas economy was sobering. Our political and business leaders began to realize that the state couldn't compete without strong institutions and educated people. We had to diversify. Tolerance and openness were not notable Texas qualities, but they were vital for creating a resilient society in the modern world. Maybe God, in His mercy, will spare Texas another oil boom. Chapter 3. Houston, we have a problem. On Thanksgiving morning, my friend Steve and I hopped on our bikes again to go see the new African American History Monument at the Texas Capitol grounds in Austin. There are two bronze wings on the monument with a frieze depicting the evolution and struggle of black Texans. On the far left stands Esteban the Moor, a slave who had been part of Cabeza de Vaca's expedition. Esteban was the first black person in Texas, and according to Steve, likely the first Muslim in America. On top, there is a pair of freed slaves, one holding the Torch of Liberty and the other with a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. On the day that the monument was unveiled, a small group, calling themselves White Lives Matter, protested the event, reminding everyone that the sentiments that led to the Civil War still resonate in some minds. Nearby, in the gateway to the Capitol grounds, stands a massive Confederate shrine, topped by a statue of Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president. There is also a monument to John Bell Hood's Texas Brigade, one of the most valiant units in Robert E. Lee's army. Out of the 4,400 men in the brigade, only 600 were still standing at the end of the war. A Confederate flag is inscribed in the shaft. Closer to the Capitol building is a monument to Terry's Texas Rangers, who were the shock troops for the Battle of Shiloh and other significant engagements. On the building itself is a plaque, which was placed there in 1959, titled The Children of the Confederacy Creed. It pledges to honor the veterans and the ideals of the Confederacy, as well as to study and teach the truths of history, one of the most important of which is that the war between the states was not a rebellion, nor was its underlying cause to sustain slavery. That the state would dignify such lives by placing them on the Capitol is shameful. You can find Confederate monuments all over the state. In 2015, the University of Texas at Austin, bowing to student demands, removed a statue of Jefferson Davis from the campus, together with one of Woodrow Wilson. Then, in the middle of the night, on August 20, 2017, workers removed the remaining Confederate statues of Robert E. Lee, General Albert Sidney Johnston, and John Reagan, who served as the Postmaster General for the Confederacy. James Hogg, a progressive governor, who was the son of a Confederate general, was also taken down. The empty pedestals remain. Steve and I both have ancestors who fought for the Confederacy. Steve's great-grandfather was a cavalry officer in Bradford's regiment, assigned to guard Galveston against a federal invasion. He is thought to have been in the Second Battle of Sabine Pass, when the Yankees attempted to invade Texas in 1863. It was the most lopsided victory the Confederates enjoyed during that war. My great-grandfather on my mother's side, Robert L. Peacock, was injured at the Battle of Chancellorsville. I have the cane, a fellow invalid, carved for Sergeant Peacock while he was recovering, as well as his pardon, granted at Appomattox Courthouse. I keep his powder flask on my desk. On my bedroom wall as a child, I had a portrait of General Lee on his revered gray mount, Traveler. The historical memory of the Confederacy and the lingering legacy of racism and separatism have always been a part of my consciousness. I went through my entire education in Texas public schools without a single black classmate. I still feel ashamed of the prejudices that I struggled to shed. As a young reporter, I covered the civil rights movement, which was, after the writing of the United States Constitution, the greatest triumph of democracy in our country's history. I had hoped that my generation would be the last to deal with racial discrimination, but hatred is a potent addiction. Just inside the doors of the Capitol building stand the marble statues of Stephen F. Austin, the entrepreneur who brought the first Anglo colonists to Texas, and Sam Houston, the first elected president of the Republic. Both men were slaveholders, despite their stated opposition to the institution. Austin inherited the Texas Project from his father, Moses Austin, who died of pneumonia shortly after gaining a grant to settle 300 families in the portion of Mexican territory that was still mostly Indian country. Stephen was an unlikely frontiersman. He was short and slight, with curly hair and a fair complexion. He was better suited as a diplomat. And had it been up to him, Texas would have remained part of the Mexican nation. Although he was initially opposed to slavery, most of his colonists came from the South, and they insisted on the need for bondage. The idea of seeing such a country as this, overrun by a slave population, almost makes me weep, Austin remarked. The colonists got around the fact that slavery was illegal in Mexico by having their slaves sign a document before entering Texas, that they were indentured servants. They remained slaves in all but the law. The statue of Houston looks like a Roman emperor in buckskin, gazing into the middle distance where destiny awaits. I much prefer the gargantuan version outside Huntsville, which is 67 feet tall, depicting the old soldier with a cane staring out at I-45. Inscribed on the bronze plaque is Houston's admonition to future Texas leaders that they should govern wisely and as little as possible. One spring day I walked around Sam Houston Park in Huntsville, with a group of rambunctious seventh graders from the Woodlands who were on a field trip for their mandatory Texas history class. We peeked through the window of the steamboat house at the bed where Houston died on the evening of July 26, 1863, spurned by the Texas he had created after laboring to spare it the fate that secession would inevitably impose. The clock on the mantel had been stopped at 6:15 p.m., the hour of his death. The kids groaned when the docent explained the function of the chamber pot next to the bed. Houston was a product of the populist revolt in America in the 1820s, a period that in many respects resembles our current era. A protege of fellow Tennessean Andrew Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party, Houston was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1823, the same year that Jackson went to the Senate. 4 years later, Houston was elected governor of Tennessee. He was a political star, ruled by the populist credo that the people are always right. At this point, one could easily have imagined a different path for him, one that would have led directly to the White House, following in Jackson's footsteps. Certainly many people expected as much from him. But a disastrous romance would change the course of Houston's life and that of the nation. A friend of mine, historian H.W. Brands, maintains that the founding of Texas was largely the result of the shocking divorce between Houston and his first wife, Eliza Allen, whom he had married in 1829. Houston was 35, tall, handsome, vain, and powerful. Eliza was 19, refined, fashionable, and delicate. 11 weeks after their wedding, Eliza returned without explanation to her parents' house. Houston resigned as governor, citing sudden calamities. The mystery of their estrangement has never been solved. Houston threatened violence against anyone who cast doubt on Eliza's virtue. He is said to have told a friend that Eliza's parents had pushed her into the marriage, although she actually loved another man. "Cursed be the human fiends who force a woman to live with a man whom she does not love," Houston supposedly remarked. Another theory suggests that Eliza recoiled at the sight of Houston's disfigured body, which bore 3 nearly mortal wounds that he sustained in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in 1814 as part of General Jackson's war against the Upper Creek Indians. Early in the battle, an arrow struck Houston in the thigh. He demanded that another soldier rip out the barbed shaft, which created a gaping hole. Jackson ordered him out of the fight, but Houston stumbled to his feet and assaulted the Indian breastworks, only to be shot twice in the right shoulder and arm. The doctors decided he was certain to die, so they turned their attention to possible survivors. The next morning, when he was found still alive, the surprised surgeons finally treated him. The massive shoulder wound never actually healed, continuing to drain throughout his life. After his marriage dissolved, Houston fled into Indian country to live with the Cherokees. They called him the Big Drunk. He became a Cherokee citizen and took a native wife. In 1832, like so many with shipwrecked ambitions, he headed to the Mexican colony of Texas to make a new start. Soon he found himself leading a kind of rebel mob that called itself an army. There was little chance that Houston's forces could defeat the larger, well-trained Mexican forces, but in April 1836, weeks after the Alamo fell, Houston caught the Mexicans napping at San Jacinto. There is a painting in the Texas Capitol of the surrender of Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. Houston is shown lying on the ground, leaning against a moss-draped live oak, his right ankle bandaged from a stray bullet wound that would render him permanently lame. The camp surgeon sits on his medical box at Houston's feet. Santa Anna, the greatest general in Mexico's history and the most dominant political figure in his country, he would serve 11 terms as president, stands before Houston, hat in hand. He had fled the battle carrying a box of chocolates, but somehow got unhorsed and was discovered the next day hiding in the grass, wearing the uniform of a private. Behind the dignitaries in the painting stands a white flag with a lone star in its center. That star would become a symbol of the Republic of Texas and then of the state representing its defiant sovereignty. The Texian soldiers without uniforms wear the rough clothes of frontiersmen. Some of them look ready to lynch the Mexican leader. Indeed, one of them has a length of rope. The slaughter at the Alamo had been followed 3 weeks later by the execution of more than 400 prisoners in Goliad on Santa Anna's orders. "Remember the Alamo! Remember Goliad!" was the cry of Houston's bedraggled army as they massacred the Mexicans in turn at San Jacinto. It was all over in 18 minutes. There's another story that Texans tell about the capture of Santa Anna, which has long been regarded as mere legend. Recent scholarship, however, makes it more likely that Houston's victory at San Jacinto came about in part because of the sly distraction on the part of a serving girl, Emily Morgan. Why, historians ask, did Santa Anna choose an untenable encampment on the plains of San Jacinto with the Texan army in front of him and a bayou prohibiting his retreat, Steve once wrote in Texas Monthly? Why, on the afternoon of April 21st, when he knew that Houston's forces were only half a mile away, was his army taking a siesta? The answer resounds through the ages. Santa Anna was in a hurry to get into the sack with Emily Morgan. Whether the legend is true or not, and even Steve has doubts, she is memorialized by the Emily Morgan Hotel next to the Alamo. There is a lesson to be drawn from Houston's career as a populist leader. He would twice be elected president of the Republic of Texas, which his decisive victory had secured. After Texas entered the Union on December 29, 1845, Houston became one of the first two U.S. senators from the state of Texas. He clearly envisioned the disaster that the proposed Southern Confederacy would inflict on the nation and on Texas. "I see my beloved South go down in the unequal contest, in a sea of blood and smoking ruin." In 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, he was elected governor as a Unionist, but the secessionists were more powerful. Houston's faith in populism as a force for progress was shattered. "Are we ready to sell reality for a phantom?" Houston vainly asked, as propagandists and demagogues fanned the clamor for secession with deluded visions of victory. To those who demanded that he join the Confederacy, Houston responded, "I refuse to take this oath. I love Texas too well to bring civil strife and bloodshed upon her." Houston was evicted as governor, and the bloodshed came. Houston's namesake city was founded in 1836, months after his victory at San Jacinto. Two New York real estate developer brothers, Augustus and John K. Allen, commissioned Gale Borden, Jr., a publisher and surveyor who would later invent condensed milk, to lay out a grand metropolis in the lowlands around Buffalo Bayou. They named the swampy new town after the hero of San Jacinto, but the brand was about the only thing to commend the place for settlement. Houston has a reputation of being an unhealthy residence, Frederick Law Olmsted, a New Yorker, disdainfully remarked on his trip through the state in 1854. He took note of the slave markets and the numerous venomous snakes. Alligator holes are an additional excitement. The unsuspicious traveler suddenly sinking through the treacherous surface, and sometimes falling victim, horse and all, to the hideous jaws of the reptile. After Spindletop hit, Houston discovered itself as the capital of an oil empire. By 1913, there were a dozen oil companies located in the city, including Humble Oil, the predecessor of ExxonMobil. Houston was a one-industry town. Stephen Kleinberg, the founding director of Rice University's Kinder Institute for Urban Research, said over coffee at a French bakery, "We did oil the way Detroit did cars." Kleinberg has been conducting an annual survey of the city for the last 35 years. When the study began, oil and gas accounted for more than 80% of the city's economy. Now it's half that. The medical center alone, the largest medical complex in the world, has more than 100,000 workers in 59 institutions, occupying an area larger than Chicago's Loop. Houston's port is the second busiest in the country. The city added more than 700,000 jobs between 2000 and 2014, almost twice the number of jobs created in New York City. People complain about the weather and the flying cockroaches, but the latest survey shows that 81% say life in Houston is excellent or good, even with the downturn, Kleinberg told me. They say that Houston is a crappy place to visit, but a wonderful place to live. When I was growing up in Dallas, we looked upon Houston as a blue-collar cousin, a fine place to go if you like